Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe. It's electrified. Boogie, woogie, woogie. So you can boogie, woogie, woogie into the forest. Boogie. Boogie, woogie, woogie through the mud. Or boogie, woogie, woogie to work, where you boogie, woogie, woogie down the hall to your boss's office to tell him you quit.
Sure got the boogie.
Then you boogie, woogie, woogie to the elevator as he boogie, woogie, woogies after you, begging, please, take me with you. Boogie. The electrified Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe. Learn more at Jeep.com. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Hey guys, and welcome to Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm Josh Horowitz. This week on the show, Daisy Ridley on Star Wars, eagle hunting, and why she left social media, and a man who's lived fast and hard and rough, just like me, Mr. Nick Nolte. But first, hey Sammy.
Hi.
My partner in crime.
You know what it just sounded like?
What's that?
That the next Star Wars movie is going to be called Star Wars
Eagle Hunting. How
I'm
awesome
like,
would that
whoa.
Be? No, to clarify, we'll get to that in a second.
Great.
But first, we should mention, yes, it's a packed show with two awesome guests. Amazing guests. I'm about to talk effusively about both of them. But first, we should mention this is our spooky Halloween edition of the show. This is our last episode before Halloween.
Is that why you look like a zombie?
No, it's just age.
Oh, got it.
Big Halloween plans for you?
I decided about an hour ago.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to have a party.
What?
Will you come?
No. I'm invited?
I tell everyone it's your party. It's in honor of you.
Yeah, it's the memorial Josh Horowitz zombie party.
Oh my God. I tell everyone that it's your memorial and then you show up.
Well, okay. So what are going to be the aspects of the party? Are you going to have tasty dessert treats?
Or no,
are
you going to be... emailed a dive bar and asked if I can reserve space for free.
Amazing.
And they said yes.
Done.
So I'm getting my David S. Pumpkins blazer ready.
Are you really going to do that?
Hell yes.
That's going to be very popular.
Well, don't – should what?
No.
I not?
No,
is
no,
it,
no.
Like, cheesy?
No, no. Here's what I would say is cheesy. I would say Ken Bone, cheesy.
Mm,
David S. Pumpkins.
Like if you know, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I approve. It's all good.
Do you want to be one of my skeletons?
No, I'm good. Thank you, though.
Okay, you're welcome.
So speaking of Halloween, there are also going to probably be a lot of Rays, as in Rey from Star Wars The Force Awakens, out this Halloween season. And that is our guest later on in the show, Daisy Ridley. And
there'll probably be a lot of the first guests, too.
Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. If you go as Nick Nolte, you have my utmost respect.
Oh, my God. That's an amazing costume.
But to tease a little bit about what you're going to hear a little later on with Daisy, she has a new movie called The Eagle Huntress, which is a documentary that she has narrated and she's the executive producer of. And it's a really sweet story that is about a 13th generation eagle hunter in Mongolia, basically. This 13-year-old girl who's the first in her family to kind of break the tradition and be a woman that's pursuing this this pastime of her family's. So it's a very empowering tale. It's a very sweet story. The family's delightful. It's beautiful cinematography. And it's a really fun conversation with Daisy about, as I said, we talk about Star Wars, of course, and a little bit about Episode 8 and a little bit about – she left Instagram a couple months ago, much to many people's chagrin, and we talk a little bit about why that was. Really great catching up with Daisy Ridley, and that's coming up a little later in the show. But first, let's talk about Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte, yeah. The voice you're going to hear, oh my God, he has lived a life. This guy is 75 years old and he's lived like three lifetimes already. He's packed on a lot of mileage onto his life.
He's still going.
He's going great. So he's starring in a new show called Graves that's on Epix. It's on Sunday nights. You guys should check it out. He plays an ex-president. And you know, he's kind of been it all in his career. He's been a TV star. He started out as like a big TV star in Rich Man, Poor Man, this huge miniseries of the time. He became a movie star thanks to 48 Hours and, you know, The Prince of Tides and a ton of other things. He was People's Sexiest Man Alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of done it all, not to mention, you know, and he's very forthright about it. He's been married, I think, at least 5 times. He's had drug and alcohol issues. We talk about that infamous mugshot that you might remember from years ago.
Classic
mugshot that he says was not actually a mugshot.
Oh.
We talk about that. We talk about his performance in the underrated Hulk movie, for my money. His performance in that movie is mesmerizing. We talk – I'm serious. I really believe that. We also talk about a movie that you guys might not have heard of that I'll just mention for context, a movie called I'll Do Anything, which is fascinating. So it's a James L. Brooks movie. The guy did Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, and it starred Nick Nolte and Albert Brooks actually, and it was intended to be a musical with, I believe, like songs by like Prince, if I'm not mistaken. And they shot it as a musical, and then in test audiences basically hated it, and they removed all the songs. So the movie exists now as just like a straight like comedic drama, like a dramedy with no songs.
Music.
Yeah. So that, for reference, that's what we talk about, sort of the saga of that film, which has just always fascinated me.
Who knew he could sing?
Yeah, we talk about that too. and one other thing for context, because Nick is one of these guys that is, he kind of rambles, but it's so fascinating. Thanks both to like that idiosyncratic voice that has like just so much gravitas to it. And he's just kind of a kook. He's kind of crazy in a great way. So one of the tangents towards the end is, if you don't catch the gist of it in listening to the interview, I'll mention it now. It's about during the making of the film The Thin Red Line, this Terrence Malick movie that starred him and everybody under the sun, a prank that went awry involving Sean Penn and Woody Harrelson. So when he talks about Sean and Woody, that's who he's talking about during that amazing story that closes out this conversation. I say it in the podcast, and I mean it. I would have Nick Nolte on every week of this podcast if I could. He has so many stories. Probably 70% of them are actually true, but that doesn't matter to me. Mm-hmm. He's kind of the best. I really fell in love with Nick Nolte. I was already a huge fan of his work, but he's kind of just a crazy storyteller, and I'm so happy he came by for this conversation. So without any further ado,
let's do it. Let's go.
Are you ready, Sammy?
I'm ready.
Have I given a good preamble?
Yes. I'm so excited.
Okay. Here's the crazy awesome Nick Nolte starring in Graves on Epix. Check it out and check out this conversation. The next voice you're about to hear, ladies and gentlemen, is one you will not mistake for anyone else's. It's the one and only Mr. Nick Nolte. Thank you for being here, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a true pleasure. What level of gushing do you want from a scale of 1 to 10? How much?
No, you can gush all you want. You know, I like that. Applause is good. You know, yay is great.
Okay, good to know.
You know, anything I can get from the audience, I'm kind of a hog, you know.
A true actor. A consummate actor.
That's what acting is. Not like a politician who's trying to serve the people, you know.
Do you see many – I mean the show we're talking about, of course, is Graves, a new show for Epix in which you play an ex-president. I'm sure you're getting this kind of question a lot, but it does beg the question what you just said. Do you see many connections between politicians and actors? I mean the politicians we see nowadays, we kind of expect them to be camera trained. We expect them to be polished.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan taught that, you know, the great communicator. And he was a B-picture movie actor, but
don't discredit Bedtime for Bonzo. Special stuff.
I didn't see it, but I heard Bonzo was great. But he made them all aware that they've got to at least become camera aware, at least look directly into the camera and talk to it. And that's, we see that happening through the years. And Reagan was mainly responsible for that. But between the actor and the politician, the politician is supposed to be to set himself aside and serve the people, a larger purpose. The actor brings himself in more and gets pleasure from the audience applauding, you know.
Sure.
I'm not saying one is more egotistical than the other, but it's a different kind of service and a different kind of function. Certainly the actor can't be a politician because he's not going to think past the play, you know.
Right.
Where the politician has to go into all aspects of human life, well, we hope so.
Do you feel in your own path and as an actor, like, is a little self-involvement, a little vanity a good thing for an actor? Is that something that behooves you, that kind of can help you? Or it would be more helpful for you or any actor to be a little more selfless, you think?
Yeah, it works all those ways. I mean, you know, you'll have your humbling moments in front of the audience when you really mess up. And you'll have those great moments where the audience is really in your palm of your hand, and you're moving with the audience's emotion back and forth as it sways. And I used to spit on the stage curtain, the fourth wall, you know, because, you know, there were 1,000 people out there. So I would do that. And so when I first started doing film, I would not spit on the lens, but I'd give the lens a real nasty look. And the cinematographer was whipping his bulldog around. You know, he'd bitten down on the chain, and so he's swinging her way around. And he said, "I don't know why you hate that camera so much. It sure loves you." Man, that just broke through right away. And yeah. He said, "Why am I spitting at the camera?" You know. It was kind of this thing to get, you know, the inhibitions out of your way, you know. Like, you know, the curtain opened and there's going to be 500 people, 1,000 people. Well, the actor goes through a process of, you know, getting lost in the part,
sure.
You know. And as you get older, you get lost easier because you're more senile.
You get it benefits you. It's
a lot
all
better. There you go. A better actor.
Do you feel like you're better than you've ever been? Do you feel like you know more and it just comes more naturally? You have more tricks in the toolbox or whatever?
Yeah. Emotionally, you know, and flow-wise, I'm better. But physically, I'm not as good as I was,
yeah.
You know, so there's a give and a take. I can't do certain kind of moves. I can't do certain kinds of things. But I know where to go. Whereas when you see an actor struggle, you know, he's not sure where he's.
It's that indecisiveness.
Yeah.
It's not known.
And
yeah.
That's part of being human, too.
Sure.
You know, absolutely. We have those moments every day. But you don't want to make that the whole performance, you know.
Sure. You know? Otherwise, it might be grating for an audience to watch someone that, like, can he get out of the room? Does he know where to go?
Yeah, see, Woody Allen, he makes a right pay of that, you know.
But we only need one Woody Allen.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right.
So your background before you even got into, and this is kind of full circle for you, you've been doing some TV in recent years, but obviously Rich Man, Poor Man was sort of where you made your name in the initial part of your career. After some time in theater, a bunch of repertory theater, correct?
Yeah, I worked theater from about 20 till I was 34. That's when Inge brought me from Phoenix to L.A. in a little one-act play of Bill Inge's called The Last Pad. And we had mounted it in Phoenix. In fact, our director had been a child prodigy Quaker. A very prominent Quaker family that always challenged the Supreme Court on laws of liberty,
mm-hmm.
You know, curfew laws and things like this. Well, this fellow had stabbed his mother-in-law 47 times when he was like 17 at the University of Chicago. And the reason he didn't—
I think that's against the Quaker book, right? I'm pretty sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely against Quaker. He told me he didn't know why he had his knife in his hand. He thought it was his wife in the bed, and it took him a long time to cross the floor. He came up to the fire escape. And he stabbed her 47 times. He didn't kill her because he stabbed her in the same spot.
Oh, sure.
47
times. That's sweet of him.
Yeah, so he was in the Illinois penitentiary. And he read this William Inge play, this one act called The Last Pan. And he got out because, you know, he didn't kill her. And he really wasn't a murderer, I don't think.
This is where I feel like it should be noted that, according to my research over the years, you have been accused of making up some tales during interviews.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I just want to put that out there. I'm not accusing you now.
No. If I say my wife was in a high wire act in the circus,
that's the red lights to go off.
Yeah. No, that's a true story. And he called me to help him put this play together. And Sally Goldwater financed it, and we put it on in Phoenix. And Bill then saw it.
Yeah.
And Bill was very despondent about Broadway, and so was Arthur Miller, in a way, because Miller and Inge had trouble getting their plays on Broadway, where Tennessee Williams, you know, he was a darling, you know. So he brought it to L.A., and it just went out of sight.
And that led to Rich Man, Poor Man, that play in particular?
Well, that's what started. That play ran for a year.
Yeah.
You know, I had a trick I used to do. I would take a can of vegetable soup. I learned to do this. This is true.
Okay.
I learned to do this as a kid to get out of school. I could swallow half the can and hold it in my upper stomach and walk around for maybe 10 minutes and then throw it out. And that's where I'd start that play, and the audience was only 10 feet away.
Right. I'm going to wait for you to end the podcast in that way.
Yeah.
I see blood on the table.
My parents found the can, you know, under the bed, so they knew what I was up to. But it was a very strong play.
So in the wake of both that experience and the miniseries, which obviously was huge, and as you said, you were 34. You were a man. You'd lived a life already.
Yeah.
Were you like itching to get into film and TV in your early 30s? Were you like, where are my opportunities? Like, no, it wasn't.
No. We thought if you were a movie actor, you were terrible. Right. Tab Hunter and, you know, Beach Party Bingo. We weren't thinking. It was of course, we were lying. When the opportunity came, we were there.
Right.
I mean, I remember I auditioned with Peter on Rich Man, Poor Man. And we had screen tests. And I knew we nailed it. So I said to Peter, I'll see you when we start shooting. He said, well, you don't know if we got it. I said, yes, I do. I said, I'll see you when we start shooting. You don't know. I said, yes, I do. And Peter had just graduated from Northwestern and was 24. But I knew we had that role. I just knew it.
And between that and, I mean, arguably, I guess it was probably North Dallas 40 and 48 Hours that really cemented you as a film star. There was also – there's like this is kind of like those things you find on IMDb that have been talked about over the years. Like it was said that you were up for things like Han Solo and Superman. Was that true? Do you have memories of going up for those kind of roles?
Yeah. Well, Han Solo or Star Wars. Lumpy Dreyfus was playing the role of Lucas, and he was sitting behind the desk. And Lucas was sitting in a chair with a couple other producers over here. And you had to know that, or otherwise you were very confused by this whole thing that Dreyfus was holding this audition.
Yeah.
And that was that situation. And then
– would you have made a good Han Solo? Did you have a good take on the character?
No, I didn't. No, I wasn't. Harrison Ford was a good Han Solo.
Pretty good.
Yeah, he's a guy who created. Superman is a schizophrenic. There's no question about it.
Yeah, there are a lot of issues with that guy.
Yeah. So that's what I told the studio. And I said, yeah, I'll play Superman as a schizophrenic. You know, he's got this mental problem. It's not bad. You know, he can handle it.
Yeah.
You know, he's got extrasensory perceptions that he can use to not freak out too much when he switches.
Sure. This take makes total sense to me.
Yeah, I thought maybe they'd get a kick out of it, but they didn't. Flash
forward, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well.
So I got criticized for turning down Fort Apache for $1 million. How dare Nick Nolte turn down $1 million? Well, I had never thought about it, you know. I had always thought about the material.
Yeah.
Fort Apache, they sent me that script. It was 300 pages long. I didn't even know where Fort Apache was, to be honest. I didn't know it was New York borough, you know. So Paul Newman did it, and yeah. Then, you know. But the producer was very upset that I turned it down, you know.
Did, once fame came, did it screw you with your head a little bit? I mean, it's tough for anybody to handle.
A little bit.
How so? Like, what, well, how did it manifest that it was?
Okay, you know, I've been doing theater for quite a while. You'd get some recognition, but not this constant thing. And when you get the constant thing, then you don't know where to hide. You know, it's, you know, all of a sudden you don't have any place to hide. So. Yeah. Drug dens are good.
That's a good hiding place.
Not too many paparazzis go there. You know, prison is always wonderful. You know, and the sheriff will always say, "You have a lot of fun in here, Nick."
Were you of the camp that your vices were fueling your artistic powers?
Oh no. No,
like
no,
drinking
no.
or whatever could help me, or no,
no? No, if I was that, I'd be dead by now. You know, that whole kind of attitude. Well, there's a few, I won't name them, but there's some great actors that keep finding new theories of acting. And one of the greatest and the latest Josh, we made a film with Josh, Greg Shapiro and I. And I cast William Hurt and this other actor in it. And I said, now these two guys, they'll have a difficult day. One will have a new theory on acting. You have to listen to it. And the other one gets depressed one day.
Right.
And he'll say, "I suck in this film. And you suck in this film. And this film sucks. Everything sucks." And you'll think, "Oh my God, we're not going to make it." But it only lasts for a day. The next day, he's forgotten all about it. But the other actor is Michael Moriarty, and Michael had a new theory of acting, and it was to be drunk all the time. So I said, "Don't react, Josh. Just listen.
Oh,
you know, doesn't mean he's going to be drunk. It's a theory." You know? But Michael's a brilliant actor, brilliant actor.
Totally, absolutely.
Yeah.
What one might argue that, you know, once you're this leading man, you look the part of the leading man, you know, you fit that role, that in some ways that did fit you and you could accomplish that, and you did accomplish that in many films, but it almost wasn't the right fit for you, that you almost have too much character and inner life and something special that doesn't necessarily suit kind of – the straight arrow leading man. Did you feel that at the time?
Yeah, because I had a very unconventional mother. I had a mother that was liberated before there was liberation. She thought the women's lib movement was a funky club. She said, "If you got to join a club to be a woman, you're really an idiot. You know, it's really easy to get around a man's world." She worked all her life, and she would say, you know, "You don't have to go to school if you don't want to. You know, school is taught by teachers that don't know how to live real life. So that's why they're teaching, you know." There are a lot of professors in my family, and, you know, she had a rebellion against them. And she was just liberated that way. For instance, she said, both Nancy and I, she said, "You kids are not going to know a color barrier. We will live with the black, or they'll live with us." And they did from when we were kids up. Mainly they lived with us because they didn't have any place for us to move into. But her assistant was a black lady, you know, so...
And did your parents, your mother, have much respect for what you were doing? Did they see the merit in it? Did they see?
My mother saw the acting. In fact, at the very last, when the Inge play was going to L.A., I had to make a decision to go or not. And I was in this, I had a desert house with these castor beans that had grown around it like big trees. And I knew a nurse, and I would feed them human blood, but it's really good. Good nutrition,
yeah,
you know.
Look it up, guys.
And this is before there was blood diseases that we have
sure.
today. You know, so she said to me, she said, now, are you going to go this way? I mean, are you going to sit in these couches and smoke joints and watch time pass? And I said, I don't know. You know, of course I was going to go over, but I just was going to play with it for a little while, you know. Because, you know, when you get the invitation, that's when you go to L.A. Right. Invitation, or you can go to New York. New York accepts young people.
Sure.
L.A. is a disaster for young people. It's just not, it's not really a town, is it?
Yeah, I grew up here in the city, and I feel it's not conducive to my personality. It feels a little one. I mean, that's the cliche, but there's something to the cliche.
Yeah,
right. You can tell me.
Yeah, my sister, she came here east, and she was 6 foot tall, best athlete. I think she would have been an Olympic swimmer had she not there been those kind of prejudices
sure.
at that time. And so she came back east, and then she worked at Lord & Taylor. She was a buyer at Lord & Taylor. And then she was the head of the Red Cross in Jersey.
Wow.
She used to get mad at me because of Sarandon and her husband asking for donations for Haitian prisoners with AIDS locked in the Haitian prison. They got $40 million off of that announcement. They had to send it all back. They couldn't find these guys. You know? So she used to jump all over me.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool. Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
So we're getting into social issues and political issues. What's on the Nick Nolte platform should he run for president? What are you running on? Would you make a good politician? Would you make a good president?
No, I'd be a terrible politician. The hours would kill me. You know, and
practicalities, true. Yeah.
I really don't have much to spread around anymore, even though I'm spreading fast, you know. That's what age does. You know, my sister is real good at this, but she's retired. She lives on a farm outside here. I'm just, you know, I got to get my wife to run for Senate.
Yeah.
And then take care of my daughter's baby by a Mexican drug dealer. And so I should be in baby poop and Senate problems. You know?
Wait, did you just get married very recently, did I hear?
No.
That's according to something. Okay.
No, I've been married many times.
I've meant the most recent, but
way
sure.
Way too many.
Yeah. What would you recommend the good number of marriages for a human being to be?
I think you need at least five.
That's the sweet spot?
Yeah, to get it right.
Yeah,
you know?
Let's not go crazy. Seven is absurd or whatever.
Yeah, sure
but two is just warming up.
Uncle Cole, he had eight wives. But, you know, he raised Jack Mules. That's a guy that can get a mule and a horse to get together. Then you used to get very jealous.
You keep me on my toes, sir. This is good. This is the best kind of interview. I love it. So, okay, let me take you in the time capsule back.
Right.
It's 1992. You get a phone call from Team Nolte. Nick, I've got great news. You're the sexiest man alive, according to People magazine. What was your reaction?
Well, first, they made me get out a Bible and swear I wouldn't treat it lightly. And I said, okay, what's
the great honor, yeah.
Yeah. They said, you're the sexiest man alive. I said, oh, you got it wrong. Walter Cronkite, sexiest man alive. I said, no, you've got it. But you've got to treat it with respect. So I did. I did as best I could.
You wore the mantle well, with dignity and grace.
There's no way I was the sexiest man alive. Just like that guy that drinks that beer, you know, missing guy, whatever his name is.
Right. Well, let me jump ahead because I want to mention a couple films that I'm fascinated by.
Okay.
One is and this might not necessarily be the first one that comes to mind for people, but I have a fascination with I'll Do Anything, the James L. Brooks film, because we've never seen the true version of that film. Yeah. It exists somewhere in a vault.
It does exist. It does exist. I've been offered to see it, but I haven't done it. Mark Catton hasn't. But the time I got to spend with Twyla and the time we worked on music and the time it would dance, it was – we spent 3 or 4 months.
So to clarify for the audience, this was like conceived as a musical.
Yeah,
it was a full-on musical.
It was a full-on musical, but the story was very complete in itself.
Sure.
The story of a father and a daughter, and he's an actor, and so he's got this daughter. And so we had Sinéad O'Connor that would send us music in a brown paper sack, you know, and Prince would be in a purple sack.
A lot of sacks. A lot of different colored sacks.
Yeah. And Jim tried everything. He would start the music out, and then the actor would start in, and then as the end of the scene would come, the music would be taken over again by the artist.
Yeah.
And we tried it with the actor singing, the artist version of.
Did you know it wasn't working? Did it feel off? Or,
I don't think anybody knew it wasn't working, because what Twyla did was the first thing she did, she said, put your hands on my hips. And you put your hands on her hips, and then she videotaped everything. And then she would move for 2 days. You just would follow her around, you know. Then she'd reverse it and put her hands in your hips. And then you'd move, and you're forced to move, you know. And then she would film
it. It's idiot-proof choreography. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that's right. She would find out what was your natural moves. Mm-hmm. Then she would combine that into choreography, and those we had moves. So that worked real well. It made sense. But, you know, my voice never got past the gravel, you know. I couldn't find any clear pitch, you know. So, what happened was unfortunate. L.A. Times talked to some people, saw a screener. And they said, we're going to review it off of this screener. And Jim said, you can't do that. You know, I'm still experimenting. And he had to make a deal with L.A. Times to sit in on the editing. Otherwise, they were going to.
Oh, wow.
You know, so they really.
That's the ultimate irony, because if people remember that film, it's a film about, like, the test screening process.
Yes. No.
And your film was scuttled by test screenings.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's insane.
Films have that weird thing, you know. It's like Tropic Thunder. It says a line in there, it's most expensive comedy ever made, or action picture. Well, it was.
All the money was worth it. I love that one as well. Maybe not anyone's favorite necessarily, but for this next film, rather, is how many of the stories around I Love Trouble should I believe? There's a lot of war around that everyone didn't necessarily get along in the best way, which happens.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's whatever.
We had a husband-wife directing team, right, that didn't seem to agree on things. And they asked me to mediate. And Julia wasn't in the mood to mediate.
It's not part of my contract.
Yeah, and like an idiot, I picked up their task. And she had a perfect right to do what she did. She got upset with it. And she was right, you know. They should have gone and talked to her if they wanted to talk to her, you know.
Is friction with a director or a co-star in your experience ever necessarily – can that – help a process, or is
it can help? It can cause a lot of dissension too. It didn't cause dissension. It caused me to go into my trailer and said, "What the hell did I just do?" You know, I had to think about it, and I think she was anticipating some kind of battle, but I wasn't upset with her at all. You know, I think she was right. It was. You know, that team split up, and then Nancy Myers does her own film.
Doing quite well by herself, for my money, one of my favorite performances in a quote-unquote comic book movie is your performance in Hulk. I think you're exceptional in that film. And truly, I can't take my eyes off of that performance. It's mesmerizing.
And that last part is really a large Shakespearean kind of kind of thing. And when I did that, I wanted it to start, you know, because here we've got all this animation. So I wanted to start at the highest level I could possibly start. And it took me maybe 3 hours to get the first words out. And Aang was very, very patient. After 2 hours, he came up and he said, "Do you think it's time to get a line out?"
Just gently. Maybe we could start rolling in an hour and a half.
I said, just about there. Just about there.
And what were you doing to get it to that level? What do you do?
Well, I had so much energy turning that the energy was faster and bigger than the words could possibly be.
Gotcha.
So I had to find the level that it could be big. And then, of course, that would next day we would shoot his stuff.
Right.
And that would inform him what he had to deal with in the father, you know. But in the end, the effects were bigger than anything anyway.
There's some good performances underneath all that stuff in there. It's worth checking out again. Now, we've had a good time. I don't want to upset you, but during the shoot, that was when this infamous mugshot came out. Did that affect your career in any way? It became a thing all in of itself,
no,
I feel like.
I don't think it did. I told him how to, you know, don't take the first offer, you know, and they'll probably start about 25,000, try to get 50.
For the shot, you mean?
Yeah, for the shot. And I said, and share it with the other sheriffs. And he listened and played like he didn't understand. But it's the outside of a hospital. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's not a mugshot at all.
Oh, really? It's not?
No. It's his personal camera.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy just made 25, 50 grand off of it?
You can see the line where it's a wall. You know, you can see it. And mugshots you're up against.
Sure. Yeah. So were you thinking at the time, oh, God, this is going to get out, and here we go. I'm going to have to deal with this kind of crap.
No. Because, I had been drinking GHB for 4 years. It was time to get off it, you know. And
in some ways, it's
on the wrong side of the road. And honestly, it could have been disastrous.
Right.
I said to the guy, he said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Nolte." He said, I didn't know it was you. I said, "Look, you did the right thing. I was on the wrong side of the road. I could have got people killed. I could have killed somebody. You could have killed me. You know, you did absolutely the right thing. Don't worry about it."
Do you feel you're in a good kind of like mental headspace now where you're at right now? Do you feel free of vices relatively? And I mean, we all have our vices to different degrees. Obviously, you never kick everything. But do you feel settled? Do you feel comfortable with who you are? And
I don't know of any more drugs to try. Certainly, I've had enough wives.
You knocked it off the list, you know.
Yeah, there's not much, not much works anymore. So that's age. I'm kind of excited about dying, but, I wonder if you just slip or do you try to hang on?
You had a big birthday. I don't want to mention the number. Does it bother you?
Like, no.
Do numbers bother you?
No.
I mean, you look exceptional. 75, it's great.
Yeah.
And clearly the acting hasn't diminished based on Graves.
Yeah, at 75, I roll it up to 80.
Just skip right ahead.
Yeah. And then when I'm like 83, I'll say I'm 80. Until I'm 85, then I'll say I'm 90.
Yeah.
If I say that, well,
he looks amazing.
But it's all, if you put my ashes in a can, it would have to be a bucket. Because this is titanium. These are white gold.
He's the bionic man sitting in front of me.
Absolutely. And I know Lee Majors, and he doesn't have any of this bionic stuff. In fact, he's had liposuction. That's the only thing he's had. I'm a little upset with him. I'm not going to go into it.
about Lee. The weird thing is Lee Majors has come up twice in the podcast in the last week.
Because really?
we just had Bruce Campbell on, and he's on a show with Lee, the Evil Dead show on Stars.
Oh,
so.
Well, I didn't even know he was still alive.
Apparently the light bulb's up.
Last time I saw him, we were playing at his country club, and he made a lot of bets, and I had this driver that was 54 inches long, Japanese, and made it. It was a psychedelic shaft, and I could nail that sucker. And we won. He had maybe $20,000 in a roll.
Yeah.
And we were driving away, and I said, well, we did pretty good today. I said, where are we going? He said, oh, I thought we'd go to the titty bar. Is any of that mine? He said, oh, no, you don't know how much it costs to get you in the tournament. Oh, geez, it's so expensive. It was all crock. I didn't hit a ball in the next day. He lost everything.
For my money, you might be the most interesting man on the planet. So here's my question for the most interesting man on the planet. Who is the most interesting person to you? Who's the most interesting actor you've worked with, director you've – in the business that we know? Yeah. I'm just curious. Who is – fascinating.
Most
beyond
of
the grave.
My dad, because I liked Marlon a lot, but
did you get to know Marlon a bit?
Or? Yeah, I did. John introduced me towards the end, and when he said Marlon wants to have dinner with you, I was with an English friend, and we were riding in. It was after Thin Red Line, and then I said, "Oh my God, Woody and I pulled that gag on John. He's going to get me back with Marlon." We can't go. Matt, we got to turn around and not go. Because I thought for sure he was going to pull that. And he didn't. Marlon was really sitting there. So it was, safe enough. But I don't know if you know about that gag. It was pretty, it was about the best gag in film that's ever been pulled. In Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll tell it quick. When I got down there, Sean and Woody had been throwing a snake in each other's trailer and all that. And Sean had gone to the local radio station and said, Woody will be in the park selling his pictures for $10 a pop and signing them this Friday or this Saturday. And so they were laughing. I was at dinner with Terry Malick and his wife and Woody and his wife and Sean and his wife, and they were laughing about all this. And I saw Terry wasn't too interested in it. And Woody asked for my number. I gave my number. And as soon as I got home, he called me. And he said, listen, would you set up an appointment with Sean for, Saturday around 4 o'clock, that you have something you have to talk to him about? And I said, are you going to hurt him, Woody? He said, no. I don't know what the gay is, but we won't hurt him, absolutely not. But he'll only believe you because you just came. Anybody else, he's not going to believe. So I did talk to Sean, and I said, I got to talk to you on Saturday if you got any time. He said, yeah, about 4 o'clock, that'd be great.
So you're going to be the fall guy here. This isn't leading to a good thing.
Yeah, so Woody calls me on Saturday about 3 o'clock. He said, come on down to the police station at Port Douglas. It's just down at the end of the main road in the park. It's that house. So I went down there, and I met the three policemen, and they looked like Mad Max guys. One of them had his sleeves rolled up, and one was in a uniform, and the other one was in a uniform, too. He said, look, you got no reckoning around. They have a warrant for this guy's arrest, but since you're a foreigner, they got to find out if you've been drinking at all. So you need to call Sean to reference you. And so he'll come down here. Now, the only thing I don't know when it goes off, do I leave the gun in? And I said, well, if you don't leave the gun in, Woody, Sean won't react. So I said, okay, the gun stays in. And he's, I was trying to get, so okay. So, I called Sean. And I said, I'm down here at the police station. I'll be right there. It's 4 minutes away. He comes down. He comes walking down a long hall. I'm sitting in a picnic bench at the back. They've ripped out the walls, and that was their end office. And this guy is sitting over in a bench here, and the cop starts talking to Sean right away about what I had done. Nothing. You know, it was that guy, Warren. He said he had to take a pee. So he went down the hall, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. Boom, bang, crash, boom, bam. That cop runs down after that, and then there was more. Boom, bang, crash. And John said, what the fuck's going on? I said, I don't know. And he got up, and he said, well, geez, being Sean, he went right towards it. And as he was going down the hall, I said, oh, it's got to be gun now, gun now, gun now. Boom, boom, boom. Sean came running back into the back door, and it was locked. The cops came in, he hit the floor. I went up in the wall because I was cracking up. I can't lay on the floor going, So I was standing on the wall like this, and Sean went down finally on all four, and this guy was, he was out of his mind. I'm getting the fuck out of here, God damn,
This is Sean going crazy.
Yeah, well, no, there was the Australian cop.
Oh, the cop was, got it, yeah.
Yeah, I got to get out of here. Hey, you kid, you can drag me out of here. Yeah, well, there's a key on the desk. I take a key on the desk. So Sean, please, just don't shoot anyway. I'll drive you anywhere you want to go. Just don't shoot. Okay, come on, let's get the fuck out of here. He gets the key, goes to the back door, opens that door, unlocks that door, opens it. There's Woody. Shot a picture. And we had two cameras down in the corner, and they got the whole thing.
Video? There's video of this?
Yeah. Video. Now,
it should be on the DVD extras for Thin Red Line. That's...
Yeah, I was never to repeat this story, but somebody gave a bad
person. Don't trust Nick Nolte with it, your secrets, people. That's one takeaway. My other takeaway is...
Oh, he's going to leave me in the jungle of Mexico with some drug dealer.
I can't think of a worse person to prank than Sean Penn. That's not high on my list.
It went kind of like this. He went... and I said to the cops, you guys want a drink? He said, yeah, let's go. We went to the pub, and we got smashed because... when they thought about it, shooting that gun off of blanks, well, only in Port Douglas in Australia.
Sure.
And because of their accents, it took on a sense of reality,
I'm just happy you got out alive, Nick, that you made it here today.
I don't know if I did. Repeating that story, maybe.
You went through it again? You just felt, I feel like you're sweating. You're now like.
Maybe I am sweating. I'm going to have to roll it out and see if. If you can use this, it might cost me my life.
No, it's going to be okay. You're protected. We'll protect you.
You don't know. Sean knows a lot of people.
Well, I'll let you go to sort that out. Okay. We're not cutting anything. I can't tell you. I mean, you're welcome here, needless to say, anytime, because you have 1,001 stories. I don't care if they're true or not. They're all amazing. the show is Graves. Everybody should check it out on Epics. It's a great piece of work, a fun political satire. You deliver a hell of a performance, as you always do, sir.
Thank you.
And it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for stopping by today.
I had a lot of fun.
Thanks, Nick. That was the amazing Nick Nolte. Once again, guys, check out Graves Sunday nights on Epics. Now, next up is one of the true kind of the future of Hollywood, one of the bright lights going on in cinema right now. She, of course, made a huge debut. It was her first film.
Which is insane.
Insane. Daisy Ridley starred in Star Wars The Force Awakens last year, and everybody fell in love with her and fell in love with that character, Rey. And as I talk about with her in this conversation, she's kind of using her powers for good. This is one of her first projects post-Star Wars in that she lent her name to this really delightful documentary called The Eagle Huntress that is out on November 2nd. You guys should check it out, whether in theaters or on VOD, et cetera. And, it's really telling that, like, Daisy is lending her star power, as it were, to a project like this that that could use, the oomph of a celebrity behind it. So we talk, of course, about The Eagle Huntress, but we also talk about a great many things, including Star Wars and why there was this weird backlash, at least online, about the character of Rey being a, quote, Mary Sue. Are you familiar with this kind of debate? So I'm not going to be able to be eloquent about it. It's kind of an insipid, insane debate, and she kind of like nips it in the bud, which is great. That a Mary Sue is, I guess, I think a character that can just like ostensibly do anything for no reason. Like, it just can solve any problem and doesn't really have like the the actual.
But the name of the movie is The Force Awakens. Right. So.
I'm with you. I'm with you. And she speaks eloquently on why she thinks that argument was totally baseless. Mm-hmm. And we also talk about, you know, she's very frank about her wrestling with social media. Mm-hmm. She was very popular on Instagram. She posted some stuff that some pro-gun folks didn't appreciate. They went after her. She left social media. She talks about sort of like negotiating that line and what that's all about. So she's great. I think she's a fantastic young actor, and I'm really excited to see what she does in both Star Wars and outside of that franchise.
I can't believe she tells you who Rey's parents are in this podcast.
That's always revealed. No spoilers.
It's crazy.
Don't ruin this for me and us. No spoilers. But just a delightful conversation with Daisy Ridley. Again, Eagle Huntress out on November 2nd. Check it out and enjoy this conversation with Daisy Ridley.
For Star Wars, The Eagle Huntress.
Star Wars, The Eagle Huntress, coming soon. Daisy, it's good to see you.
You good to see you?
It's been a while. This is all for a different kind of a cause, a very sweet cause. This is a great movie. Congratulations.
Thank you.
By the way, since I've seen you, I was at Skellig Michael, and you were not there. I went for vacation. I was in Ireland for vacation for my birthday.
Really?
And we decided to take a little trip.
It's beautiful, huh?
It's amazing.
Yeah. Was the weather good?
It was Ireland. It was Irish.
Yeah,
but it was great. But there was neither you nor Mark Hamill nor porta potties. There was nothing.
We were hiding. We had some other stuff to do there. Okay. We were just trying to solve the woes of the galaxy, you know.
No, I understand. Yeah. I understand. You're busy also because not only are you an actor now, you are an esteemed executive producer.
Esteemed, not so sure.
Well, you're an executive producer. I feel like this is a very telling moment for any actor in their career after they've had like the first kind of flush of success, what they do with that power in a way.
Mm.
Because, you know, this is the first thing you put your name on since Star Wars.
Yeah.
So give me a sense of coming off of that unique opportunity. What was your agenda in terms of...
I also did Only Yesterday, which was a Studio Ghibli film.
Oh, sure, that's right. Yeah.
So I guess I'm saying, that's in Asia too. Well, I watched the film and was... The thing is, I didn't set out to be like, oh, this is what I want to do and like this is what I'm going to do when I'm, you know, in the next year of my life. It just so happened that I was sent this film and it was amazing. And I wanted to be part of it, and Otto was happy for me to come on board. And then I was able to narrate it too. So it was like just a great timing thing.
Yeah. So what struck you the first time? I mean, does this happen a lot where like someone wants to put something in front of you just to get your feel?
It happens more with books, and I'm a big reader, so I love that. This is the first thing it's happened to with a film. The thing that struck me, honestly, was the relationship between Ashley Patton and her father, because me and my dad are close and our family are very close. And it's funny, people have asked about parallels between Ray and her. I think I see it more with my life, because they're just... It's not like a statement that her parents are making, like, we're going to do this great thing for you. That just is how they are.
Right.
They want their child to do what she wants to do.
Right.
And they're supportive and encouraging, and it's not this big showy thing. So that was the main thing. Then secondly, obviously... the empowerment story of someone being able to do exactly what they want to do.
Right.
And again, I think it's not about her winning the competition. She just wants to be part of it, and she does that. So she reaches her goal. And then it's just beautiful. It's an incredible place that we don't know much about. To see a slice of life, of their family life, in a very kind of unknown community, so far away from what most of us live, is super cool.
Well, I think that's also like the what makes this film special. I think you hit on most of the notes that I was going to as well, because yes, it's like it's a landscape you probably haven't seen much, if at all, in film, and it's beautifully shot. Yet it is an extremely relatable story.
For sure.
And I think that's there's a real sweetness to this family and to this young girl who's what, 13 years old.
Yeah.
And you know, I feel like she doesn't see limits because her father hasn't put limits
exactly.
on her.
So for her, it's like no big thing. She's just doing this thing. In her community it is, but not as a socially
right.
impactful way as it will be. It's just nice.
When you were growing up, did you feel any limits placed on you based on solely on your gender at all? Did you feel
that
anything was off the table for you?
Which honestly is why I was surprised at everything that went on with Star Wars. Because for me, like surrounded by brilliant women, my mom has always worked. And I never heard anything about, you know, any kind of difficulty she had. She may have done.
Right.
She has some close female friends who I'm very close to. So it was honestly never a thing. And then because I wasn't looking at film in that way, and my favorite films like Mulan were about women anyway.
Sure.
So I guess I didn't really see the thing. And now I'm like, holy moly. But more honestly now for diversity. Like I went to go see a play in London and like every single cast member was white. And suddenly you're like so aware. Yeah. I went from being totally unaware to so aware.
And even 10, 15 years ago, that would have been the norm. And
exactly. And I guess it's saying something that now that's not the norm anymore. It's like slow progress. But I never felt limits, no.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Were you struck by, I mean, as much, and there was like, I feel like the ratio was 99-1 in terms of the love that came for Rey and for that character. Much like in a weird different way, like Ghostbusters had that same thing. I feel like we're like kind of the crazies kind of came out of the woodwork and assigned this weird, frankly, misogynistic kind of overtone to the narrative around that film. Were you aware of that for Rey as well when the people were coming out and saying she's a Mary Sue and all of that?
Mary Sue thing, I was just confused by. The thing is, and I think, again, this film is amazing because it's about inclusiveness and about how a community far away, people just live the same kind of lives. Like we don't all hunt eagles, but we all sit around as families and we eat together and we drink together and we have conversations. And with so much being so divisive at the moment, to see something that's just pure and good is nice. Like the Mary Sue thing, I just didn't get because it wasn't true. But for the most part, whenever anyone is mean, and I'm not saying whenever anyone has genuine criticism about something.
Sure, that's fair, but yes.
Mean, it's irrational and it doesn't make sense. Because any comments that people had, the Mary Sue thing in itself is sexist.
Yeah.
Because it's a name of a woman. And everyone was saying that Luke had exactly the same thing. I think Rey is incredibly vulnerable and nothing she's doing is for like the greater good. She's just doing what she thinks is the right thing.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to do some of it, but she like feels like compelling to do it. So for me, I was just confused. And then there were people making comments about John, but it was funny because then for the most part, the Mary Sue thing came afterwards. But people in general were so great about it.
But by and large, it feels like, I mean, this is all... There's so much love out there, as I said. And this is going to be the first Halloween post-Star Wars. You're going to see hell of a lot of Rays out there.
Yeah.
Not to mention Jyn Erso, I think, is also going to be out there as well.
JJ literally emailed me 2 days ago. He just met a guy who had a baby called Ray Park.
Oh, my God.
I know.
I saw Felicity back in Toronto for her films.
For Monster Calls.
Oh, my God. Have you seen a Monster Calls yet?
I cried in the trailer.
Dude,
I haven't seen the film.
It's
cried in the trailer.
I've seen it twice.
It's just amazing.
I think it's my favorite movie of the year. I'm actually tearing up talking about it right now because it will wreck you in a great way. It's a beautiful film. But she was saying she was going off to see you like literally that next week.
Yes.
I've heard you guys have connected by now. Was that, I mean, you don't have to recreate the conversation. I'll be Felicity, you be Daisy. No.
Okay.
But what was important for you to kind of like talk
to
her about?
Well, firstly, I went to the Rogue One set and we met very briefly and we had the same dresser. Callie, and she was like, you two would get on really well. So I wanted to meet her anyway.
Sure.
In fact, she used my whole same team, my hair and makeup too. Obviously I didn't tell her this, but I really love her work, like really do. And I remember when I left Theory of Everything, I said to my sister, if I ever make anyone feel like she just made me feel in that film, like I'll be happy.
Sure.
And then it was just interesting because obviously she's about to go into the press tour. And she's done so much work, but she's not done something with the press schedule being that as it.
Very few have, to be fair, yeah.
Yeah, and with Asia and everything. So we were just talking about that. So it was nice because it was like actually points of reference as opposed to this thing that feels so far away.
Yeah,
now.
Despite like a young career, this is like the one thing you can speak with authority on. Like, actually, I know how to do this.
But also suddenly it was like, you know, you get so bogged down with people saying, oh, it's so... it's everything's, I mean, so much is so negative in the world, and like, and people really freak me out about how life was going to be. And then suddenly I'm like,
you know, your life's about to change.
Exactly. And like, I'm on the, I've started using the tube and stuff again. Like, it's no biggie.
Yeah.
And it was just nice remembering how amazing of a time I had.
I will say I'm very sad that in recent months I lost my social media buddy.
You left.
What happened? So it had nothing to do with the hate and stuff, because there was some, again, the crazies kind of came out
a little bit.
For
you, Josh, I'll tell you. The gun thing for sure had nothing to do with
okay.
it. The reason I took that down was I was like, oh my God, I really have nothing to do with this, because in England, the gun's not a thing. Some people were not very nice. And yes, that had something to do with it. Honestly.
No, it's fair. I mean, yeah.
But for the most part, I didn't feel good at that time. And it gets to a point sometimes when you're like putting on a thing because you're like, I have to post. And like, I'm seriously like going through my life. Like, I have stuff I'm dealing with. I mean, nothing huge, but we just finished the film. And
sure.
It was just an odd time. And I felt like I didn't really have anything to post about. Honestly, that was it. It is tricky because, God, I never thought I'd get into this, to be honest, because you think like my whole thing is self-love and stuff like that. So when people are not nice, it kind of seems so odd because I never like put a filter. I know that I have flaws, as everyone does, and I've never been shy of hiding them. So, but for the most part, honestly, it's because I had nothing to post and I still don't have anything to post.
Okay.
So, I've literally been
on
vacation.
We hope you'll come back
so
eventually.
I think we'll see next year.
Okay.
It's been nice to be off. Apparently the cool kids in school are taking social media breaks where they don't go on for a week.
Cool.
Honestly, someone told me that this morning.
Whatever gets you to sleep at night, Daisy.
Exactly.
Okay, so, and where are you at in terms of just, lending your name and voice to this, literally.
Yes.
Just finished episode 8. You haven't acted in something, you know, your entire body in a while outside
You're
of Star Wars.
Me.
Does that feel weird to you? Are you itching? Because you've signed
it's
on
terrifying.
To some things.
Yes.
Murder on the
Orient
Express.
I auditioned for Murder on the Orient Express. And it was nice because I was actually talking to Adam about it, because I was terrified because we spoke a couple weeks ago. and he was like, yeah, but you auditioned. It's great. And I don't know. It's weird. Like, for sure, I feel with that cast, I'm not worthy. But I'm a huge fan of Kenneth Branagh and literally every single person in it.
You get to have some interesting relationship with Leslie Odom Jr.
Yes.
A way to get closer to Hamilton.
Yes. And what's funny is last time I was here, me and Stephanie, who's in this room, we went to Hamilton.
I'm so jealous.
It's like a weird circular kind of thing. Cyclical.
But yeah, Bran is the best.
I'm nervous.
He's amazing.
But also it's like so different. It's period and
right.
And it's like we're all just in compartments. Like there's no running away. I can't run away from the terror.
Is that the next thing you're going to be acting in?
Yes.
Very exciting.
And then I have some stuff lined up next year, which is super cool.
So episode 8, which I know you can't say anything about, but tell me, was it a much different experience kind of working with Mark Hamill versus Harrison? They're two very uniquely different human beings.
They're very uniquely different human beings. No one's asked me that. It was very different, yeah. I don't know how, just different energies.
Yeah.
They've lived different lives. They, yeah, just different people. But it was great.
One of the things I've heard through the grapevine, and this, I don't think this reveals anything, is that there, in addition to Ray, there are other significant female characters.
Hell yeah! Kelly Marie Tran.
That's
you
what I'm
what?
Hearing. She's got a very key role in this film.
Yeah, she does. I mean, I think it would have been odd if they did an announcement with her, Benicio, and Laura for her not to be a big part. She's a crucial role, and it's really exciting.
Has Ray changed a lot in the last 4 seconds that took place between episode 7 and episode 8?
In the last 4 seconds. There's a big journey, yeah.
Between the films?
During the film.
Okay, I hope so.
In the 4 seconds, she's like thought, what am I going to have for dinner?
Right.
Is this guy ever going to take this lightsaber? I'm literally standing here like a lemon.
But within the film, a big journey.
Yeah.
A lot happens. I would hope. I hope it's not just them sitting like
exactly.
at the top of that mountain.
They're like, hey, Luke, how's it been? Tell me.
Fill me in.
Fill me in.
So it seems like, you know, we've talked about how the importance of a film like this being a positive beam of light in this dark universe we seem to be in right now.
Yeah.
As we sit here today, the last debate, he was here in the US last night.
Yes.
Are you...
I ordered some cookies last night to help me get through it.
Did you? Do you feel involved in the US political machinations? Do you feel...
Yeah, I do. I mean, Brexit was horrendous. And for anyone who lived in London, we were gobsmacked and devastated.
So you're here to warn us it could happen. It could happen to us.
I think, honestly, a lot of Americans have said they were so surprised that Brexit happened that now it was more likely that Trump was going to get in. I was here for the first debate. I was in Australia for the second. I for sure feel a big part of it. Plus, you know, I'm in America a lot and I love America and I love American people. So it's on my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there... So Murder on the Orient Express is the next role, which sounds like a much different kind of a thing. Is there a kind of a role that's not coming your way that you hope people think of you for? I know that a big moment for you was working with Barbara Streisand recently.
Oh, my God.
It was a bucket list moment. Who could even put that on their bucket list?
Exactly. It's one of those things you can't even imagine that it will be a dream until you do it. And then you're like, this is a dream.
Yeah, the universe is being really good in coming up with things you never could have imagined for yourself.
Exactly.
Like, what else do you have in mind for me, universe?
But honestly, I'm very much like, I believe everything happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, I auditioned for something just before Murder on the Orient Express with a director who I would have loved to work with, and I didn't get it. And I was sad, but I'm for sure, like, the timing didn't work. And I remember my agent, Hilda, who's a boss, she said, you know, the train's going through a station, it just wasn't your stop.
Sure.
And I think that timing is a big thing. So as of yet, no, I'm reading incredible books. I have a couple like development things going on, and the stuff I'm able to do next year, like, it's a wide variety.
Nice.
So it's very exciting, yeah.
Last television or film that you went insane for? Anything that you're really obsessed with right now?
I mean, Stranger Things.
Pretty great.
Really want to be friends with Millie Bobby Brown. what did I last see at the cinema? I'm waiting to see Sing Street, which, funnily enough, Lucy Boynton is in Murder on the Orient Express. Oh my gosh, saw the boss on the plane, almost wet myself laughing. So good.
She's kind of the best at that kind of thing.
She's the best.
Yeah. And Kristen Bell's not bad either.
Gorgeous too.
Yeah.
Kristen Bell's great. The little girl in that, brilliant.
Totally.
The whole thing. Also, I thought the stunts were amazing.
Right.
There were so many stunts, people getting thrown downstairs.
Just her, the bed gag, her just...
bed gag. Best thing ever.
We're ending on happy notes.
Yes.
This is good.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, what's the key to delivering good voiceover, giving good narration for the aspiring narrator out there?
Okay, so I've always wanted to actually narrate something,
yeah.
Especially something with such beautiful vistas. So I was going for the Oh, in Mongolia, it's so great. He was like, rein it in. I think it's less is more,
okay.
Probably. But also, it depends on what you're doing it for.
Okay.
So the vista stuff, I was more indulgent.
Right.
And then the day-to-day stuff, all it is, as Otto says, is like a handhold to like eight-year-olds in the audience who might lose themselves in
Got
the
it.
Subtitles. So it's just a little nudge in the right direction.
Do you want to end our podcast signing off for us to practice your narration?
Sure. I've not had a rehearsal of this.
You're a professional.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
This episode of Happy, Sad, Confused was produced by Michael Catano, James T. Green, Mukta Mohan, and Kasia Mihailovic for the MTV Podcast Network, with additional engineering by Little Everywhere. You can subscribe to this and all of our other shows on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you find your favorite podcasts.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.